Aquí de lunes a jueves. You will find it.
The Safari Park.
You're killing me, Larry.
Hello, Larry.
Hats off to Larry.
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 Larry. Larry, get into bed now.
Come on, Larry.
Is there no sweeter sound than that of your own name buried in cheers and applause? I think not. So this Elon Musk guy is getting a lot of play, especially here in California. Now about this Hyperloop that will shuttle people from L.A. to San Francisco in 30 minutes. Six people climb into a tube and some electromagnetic magic will slingshot them to their destination at 700 miles an hour. Whoosh. I don't know about this guy Musk. On the face of it, he seems okay, because he's operating in the real world, not the digital world. He's like a throwback to the business titans of the past. You do have to snicker at Zuckerberg and Brin or Dorsey. I mean, how do you compare guys who made it possible to share cat videos and latte toppings to, say, Howard Hughes? The digital guys come up a little short on the swashbuckling meter, don't they? Think of Hughes, out there in the middle of the Texas oil fields, with a drill bit that could chew its way to China, and then off to buy a movie studio so he could tag every pointy starlet from Ava Gardner to Rita Hayworth, the pointiest of the pointy, bar none. Then he goes and builds the world's largest aircraft and flies it like it's a stunt plane. Next stop, Vegas, where he buys half the strip and holes up in a penthouse for years, where he descends into seclusion and madness. That's my kind of tycoon. Then there's Musk's assertion that we are all now, right now, living in a computer simulation a la The Matrix. We've got to deduct major points from him for that lunacy. And then there's SpaceX. Sounds like a rental studio for porn shoots. And the Tesla. That's a really shit name. Granted, old Nikolai knew his way around volts and watts, but still, Tesla is as lame a name as Edsel. Cars should have cool names, and they don't. In fact, automotive nomenclature sucks. I want to drive a Wildcat or an Eldorado, a Monte Carlo, a Thunderbird, Cougar, Roadrunner, a Cutlass, Grand Prix, Barracuda, Galaxy. How about a Starfire? Or here's one for Dick Masterson, a Fury. In fact, I'll drive the Fury, and maybe some of Dick's dickheads can design him a Rage-mobile like Ed Big Daddy Roth. I can see it now. Tire-slashing Ben-Hur wheel hubs and a hood-mounted minigun, all held together by zip ties. What the fuck is a Tercel? An Accord, a Prius, a Yaris. Yaris? Sounds like a name some flaky mama would give her kid just to fuck him up from birth. Yaris! Yaris, get in the house for dinner this instant! Or a Leaf. Yeah, I want to drive a Leaf, because when you're camping, we wipe our asses with leaves, don't we? Now there's some sexy marketing imagery for you, Nissan. Maybe that's only topped by the Cube. Who walks into a car show and says, "Hey, where's that new Cube? That's one sexy rod." What the fuck has happened to automobiles? With few exceptions, manufacturers are building them as if they're apologizing for being automobiles. Like they really mean them to be smartphones with wheels. And topping the list of all is the smart car. The car that makes you a punchline. Because who doesn't want a car mostly designed by an outfit that manufactures cheap plastic watches? That's right, the S for Swatch and M for Mercedes, and they tagged it with art. And that car is indeed art. It's a cartoon. And manufacturers of cheap plastic watches, they know all about automotive design, don't they? More than anything, a car represented the passage into manhood, a ticket to adventure and freedom, a rolling boudoir where a guy could turn his horses loose and impress his lady. But back to Musk's Hyperloop. Start with the name. Sounds like a vomit-inducing ride at Magic Mountain. In fact, it doubtless borrowed some of its technology from exactly that place. They got a ride up there called Superman that does a vertical acceleration to 100 miles an hour in 7 seconds, and they do it with magnets. And there's nothing new about a pneumatic tube transporting passengers either. In the 1860s in Manhattan, some guy named Eli Beach built a little block-long pneumatic shuttle. And Beach had a lot more style than Musk. His station had a fountain, a crystal chandelier, and a grand piano. So Musk's got this prototype built out in the Nevada desert. And it's a pod, of course. Everything's a fucking pod. How about calling it something else? I don't know, a capsule or conveyance. Enough with the podology. And you're in there with 6 strangers. And what if one or more has B.O. or bad breath? Is there a toilet on the thing? Because you know there are jackasses who won't remember to go before they leave and won't be able to gut it out, even for 30 minutes. No stops, no detours, and absolutely zero opportunity for adventure. Hamsters on a fast wheel. Fuck that. Will it have windows? Maybe. But at ground level, what's there to see at 700 miles an hour? And they're sure as hell not going to build it with an ocean view. It all sounds kind of creepy. The drive from L.A. to San Francisco via U.S. 1 is one of the most spectacular on the planet. Even the ride on the interior road, Route 5, has some great scenery. But in the Hyperloop, we'll be looking at the back of somebody's head, or one of those stupid little airplane video screens. But you'll be in San Francisco in 30 minutes, so we can get into another meeting and pull out our tablets or laptops and look at another screen. Great. I'll take a road trip, thank you. A road trip can change your life in a way no 30-minute blast through a dark tube possibly could. What do I mean? I grew up in New York and was crazy curious about the West. The pull of it was infinitely stronger than Musk's magnets. After high school, a buddy of mine moved to New Mexico. I had saved some cash. It was burning a hole in my pocket. There was this cool stereo I wanted, but then my pal Frank asked me if I wanted to visit him in New Mexico. I was torn. Stereo or trip? Stereo or trip? So I asked my mom. She looked at me like I was nuts. You can buy stereos the rest of your life, but you'll only be 18 once, with a friend in a place you've never been to before. The West, or what I'd seen of it in movies and TV, just blew me away. The sunsets, the vistas, the mountains, the deserts, the roads that go on forever. I'd been jazzed by Kerouac's book, On the Road, and soon I was going to live it. New York, or what is referred to as the tri-state area, is a megalopolis. I always felt confined there. If you were anywhere in the 5 boroughs, you had to travel hours, hours, to get anywhere where you were not tripping over another human being. And the neighborhoods, cities, and states are merely cartographic. There's damn little difference between New York or New Jersey or Connecticut, and I always felt kind of claustrophobic. So I get on a plane, and in a few hours I'm in the land of enchantment, New Mexico, which is horizontally bisected by the most famous and fabulous road in the world, Route 66. Yeah, baby. The glow of spectral neon against the orange twilight of the New Mexican horizon was a sight to behold. Plastic fantastic, as far as the eye could see, the Conestoga wagons of Pioneer Chicken, the golden arches of Mickey D's, Mobil Oil's Pegasus prancing over the skyline, Colonel Sanders' revolving striped buckets of extra crispy joy. What more could an American youth want? Cruising that ribbon of asphalt with 390 cubes of FOMOCO muscle under the hood of my pal Frankie's vintage Crown Vic. American graffiti. But I wasn't watching it on a screen. I was living it. Albuquerque was a lot smaller than New York. And when you got to the edge of town and stepped off the sidewalk or crossed the road, you were out of town. It ended as if cut with a cleaver. Not so with New York. It just tapers off a little. And then when you think you might be out of the city, you're actually in the suburbs of Philly. We hung around Albuquerque for a while. I got my first taste of horseback riding. And it was glorious. No guides, no trails, no liability waivers to sign, and no fucking helmets. Just pay your cash to the kid in the Stetson, put your ass in the saddle, and go. Try to be back by dark were the only instructions. I looked at this cowboy, and he had a blingy belt buckle the size of a football. Looked like something from a trophy case. I asked him about it. He'd won it in a big-time rodeo. I was duly impressed, and asked him when his next rodeo would be. Never, he said. Now I was really curious, because the kid looked to be about my age. A bronco had kicked out one of his kidneys, and he figured he'd quit while he still had one left. For several consecutive days, we rode through the desert, across arroyos and mesas, and saw all the shit two kids from Queens could hope to see. Javelinas and rattlesnakes and hawks and vultures and mule deer and prairie dogs and roadrunners. It was fantastic. But then, as dudes of a certain, or any age do, we got restless. We'd already cruised the strip from end to end and knew, as all adventurers and explorers do, that there had to be something else, something more, over that painted horizon. And one night at Dairy Queen, or maybe it was Foster's Freeze, it matters not, Frank and I heard the siren call that has been luring young men for centuries. Go west. And we flashed on it. A road trip. Where to? Well, California, of course. Now in his first semester at UNM, Frank had made some new friends, and one of them wanted to tag along. Steve. No problem. He'd help defray the cost of gas and lodging. Now, lodging would be a major factor in defining that trip. My first time in the Arizona desert, looking at some gigantic mountains, the sun shifted a smidge, and damn, so that's where they got Purple Mountain's majesty. Those mountains were as purple as a pimp's upholstery. We stopped overnight in Tucson. Steve's family had friends who would put us up for the night at their house. Sure enough, it was literally on the edge of town. To the west of it was nothing. Just two-lane blacktop, surrounded by the desert. We rolled in there late afternoon. The guy was some kind of preacher, had a nice wife and a few little kids. He did seem a little too perfect. Perfect hair, perfect teeth, and a perfect smile that weirdly never left his face. Their mom made a big spread of hot dogs and burgers. When he said grace, it went on like a sermon. It was bowling night in Tucson, so off we went to the lanes. An all-family adventure wasn't exactly what we had in mind, but the trip was young, and the lodging and grub were free. After a couple of games, we headed back to their place and unrolled the sleeping bags on the living room shag carpet. In strange places, I tend to sleep light. A little after midnight, I heard something. I woke up. I looked around. Who do I see but the preacher man, tiptoeing around the kitchen in his patent leather dancing shoes? The guy's all duded up like he's headed for a nightclub, and I'm thinking, what the hell? He sees me, see him, gives me that John Edwards smile and puts a finger to his lips. Then he pops open a kitchen cabinet and yanks out a bottle of Jack. Pours himself about five fingers, straight. Chugs it like iced tea. The Jack goes back in the cupboard. He takes his car keys off a hook and throws me a thumbs up and a wink. Then he's out the front door. I hear an engine turn over, tires on the driveway gravel, and I go back to sleep. The next morning, the perky, nice blonde wife makes a big ham and egg breakfast, but Preacher Man is nowhere in sight. One of the kids, he was maybe 4 or 5, says, Mommy, where's Daddy? Ain't he hungry? And she says, I couldn't tell you, Jimmy. Then she shot me one of the saddest looks I've ever seen on a human face. When we made San Diego, it was raining torrentially, the hardest rains California had had in a quarter century. We'd been staying in low-end joints, mostly Motel 6. Must have been a convention in San Diego that night. The town was booked solid, including the Motel 6. But right next door was another joint. Had an even more low-rent look. The gink at the front desk. Hey now, there's a word you don't hear too often. Gink. It's got a great sound, yes? Not a geek, a gink. Not easy finding a definition of the word gink. While a geek can have a positive spin, right? A knowledgeable nerd, there's an element of the weird to gink. They usually have some creepy mannerisms, like Tony Perkins in the original Psycho. That's your classic gink. So the desk clerk is a gink. His shirt's about 3 sizes too small, and there's a kitty cowboy hat hanging down his back from a very ornate cord around his neck. We tell him we need a room, and he says,
"Well, rooms are a little hard to come by around these parts on a rainy night like this."
Then he gives us a rate that would be about right for the Ritz-Carlton. Our jaws drop, and he says,
"Take it or leave it."
We had a quick confab. It was late. We were tired and hungry. So we decided to let the ginky bastard gouge us. We took some shit. But I wasn't too pissed off. I just had a feeling we'd somehow settle this score. Next morning we were out of there, chop-chop, and headed north. Sure, we were going to check out all the tourist crap. Disneyland and Knott's Berry Farm and Universal. I recall little of that artificial packaged fun, but I do remember paying a call on Steve's Uncle Buford. Uncle Buford lived in a tiny bungalow. Not sure which part of L.A. it was, but there was a bail bondsman on every corner and bars on every window. It was late afternoon, and Steve knocks on the door and knocks on the door. Nothing. Maybe Uncle Buford is out getting his Bentley washed. That's when we notice a movement behind the Venetian blinds. The door pops open, and Uncle Buford hurries us inside like there's zombies chasing us. Maybe there were. Inside his little crib is as dark as a cave. Only a small TV with rabbit ears give light to the room. On the TV, Bluto's got Popeye in a headlock. And I get a good look at Buford, and he's got a fair-sized revolver stuck in his belt, like Josie fucking Wales. Holy shit, this neighborhood must be worse than it looks. He asks us,
"You boy thirsty?"
When he opens his mouth, I see he's a member of the Brush After Christmas Club. Maybe 5 teeth in his head. He disappears into a kitchen and comes back with a single bottle of Dr. Pepper.
"When you finish this, pause, I'll get you another."
We were pals, but not drink from the same bottle pals. He suggests we all go out to the yard where it's more comfortable. I'm for that. The yard was about the size of a septic tank with San Quentin decor. 6-foot cinder block walls on 3 sides topped by a tangle of razor wire. Out there was Uncle Buford's dog, Boots. He looked like a border collie. Cute dog. Uncle Buford sits himself down in a folding chair, lights up a Camel, and he and Steve start to catch up on family news. I can hear gunfire not too far off, and sirens, lots and lots of sirens. I'm wondering how Popeye's doing with Bluto on the Motorola. After a while, Boots starts to climb on Steve, and Uncle Buford snaps too like he sat on a tack.
"Boots! Boots! What the hell are you doing? How many times I gotta tell you, dog?"
That's when he wraps one gnarled hand around Boots' snout, and with his other hand takes the Camel from his toothless gub and holds the lit end under Boots' nose. Not close enough to burn him, but close enough to get him started down the road to emphysema. Boots whines and sneezes, and Uncle Buford intones,
"You gonna mind me, Boots? Huh? You gonna mind me?"
I wanted to do something, but in his belt, Uncle Buford had 6 compelling reasons for me not to. After a while, Steve and Uncle Buford were all caught up on the family gossip, who was doing time where and what their parole prospects were. And we left. In the car, I asked Steve why Uncle Buford was still on the lam. He wasn't sure. but he said his uncle had always had difficulty with the law. Away we went, up the mind-blowing vistas of the Pacific Coast Highway. There were few cars on the road. Only we were nuts enough to continue on in the torrential rain. Mudslides were fairly often, and once in a while boulders the size of a commercial washing machine would tumble onto the roadway, just missing the car, and then fall hundreds of feet below to the Pacific. We hoped to make at least Monterey by dusk, but it wasn't a bee. A little ways north of San Simeon, the road was buried 10 or 12 feet deep in a mudslide. We could hear a bulldozer on the other side of the mound, so we scrambled up to have a look. Just as we got to the top, the guy cuts the engine and hops out. There's another guy in a Caltrans car with the motor running. I ask the bulldozer guy why he's quitting. Says they never do it at night anymore. That some guy had tried that a few years back, went off the cliff in February, and they couldn't get his body out until March. I didn't know if he was bullshitting, but given the scale of the terrain, it seemed plausible. Well, now what? We're halfway between L.A. and San Francisco and can only backtrack. It's getting dark and raining like hell. A few miles south was a wide spot in the road. Two rusty gas pumps, a tiny cafe, and 8 or 9 wooden cabins hanging off the cliff. Inside was a quiet girl. She was the desk clerk, waitress, and maid. The girl said there was room at the inn, but dinner was only being served for another half hour. Sold. She hands me a room key and a book of matches. I asked what the matches were for. They were to light the candles, because after 10 o'clock, they shut the power off. It really didn't matter much. There was no TV in the cabin anyway. We had dinner. It was something weird, like bologna sandwiches on white bread. We were pretty tired and conked out. Sometime in the night, I woke up, went outside. The rain had stopped and all the clouds had vanished. Stars-o-rama. There was a perfect full moon over the Pacific. Not too far out, a pod of whales snaked up the coast. When they let fly, the spray from their blowholes glistened in the moonlight. In the morning, we continued north. The road was clear, and so were the skies. We hit Yosemite, San Francisco, and everything in between. On the way back to Albuquerque, we stopped again in San Diego. Went out on a fishing boat from Point Loma, and for the first time in my life, I won the pool with a lunker of a lingcod. We had a hell of a catch, threw it on ice in the trunk of the car. That night, we decided to visit Tijuana. It was all we were told it would be, and less. We left hastily and returned to Diego with some TJ tequila. We sat on the balcony of our motel, overlooking the pool of the motel next door, the same motel that had price gouged us on our way in some 10 days earlier. I looked at Frank and Steve and proclaimed I had an idea. And that idea was to stock that price-gouging, shrunken-shirted, kitty-cowboy hat-wearing gink swimming pool with fish. Dead fish. We all agreed it was a hell of a plan. Even the tequila thought it was a kick-ass idea. We retrieved the fish, put them all in a couple of pillowcases, hopped the fence to the place next door, and stealthily slipped the fish into the swimming pool, desperately trying to suppress our horse laughter. Mission accomplished. Back to our balcony for more tequila and to observe what the result of our little endeavor might be. For about a half hour, nothing. Just looking at a couple dozen fish floating belly up, slowly swirling in the chlorinated water. We were about ready to call it a night when what should appear but a late bather? A lady in a terry cloth robe. It was another gorgeous starlit night, with a gentle breeze rustling the palm trees. As our girl made her way to the pool, her head was tipped back, admiring the celestial display. When she got to the pool, she removed her robe and laid it on a chaise lounge. Not pointy, but not bad. She was still gazing upward at the night sky as she dipped a foot in the shallow end of the pool,
inserting her toe into the mouth of my prize-winning ling cod. Now she looked down and inhaled and screamed. With alarming speed, the gink was at her side, rendering her comfort. He wrapped her in the robe and escorted her to her room, muttering apologies, his cowboy hat bouncing on his back as he walked. We went inside our room and nearly laughed until we puked. We flicked on the TV, figuring the night was done. But we were wrong. In about 5 minutes, there's a flashing red light splashing through the window. I opened the door. Cops. There's a prowl car across the way, and the gink is waving his arms and pointing at his swimming pool. Ooh. We killed the television and the room light and watched and listened with the door and window open a crack. We couldn't hear very much, just a word here or there. In about another minute, a second cop car arrives, and I'm thinking, where the hell are we? Mayberry? In New York, the only time cops were called was when a body was discovered. Here we are in San Diego, and the heat here is so bored, they can send out 2 prowl cars because there's dead fish in the pool of a third-rate motel? Soon, somebody else joins the conversation and starts pointing at our motel, and we make out the words, college kids, noisy and drinking. And one cop starts walking to our motel. I cannot believe this. He's gonna do a goddamn room-to-room search. We had 2 amazing chunks of luck. One, he started on the lower level at the far end of the motel, and 2, parked directly below our balcony, was a utility van. I went over the rail, onto the van, and down onto the asphalt. Frank and Steve tossed our bags to me as I tiptoed to the car. We jumped in, fired it up, and eased out of the lot. In the rear view, we could see the cop knocking on yet another motel door. Being kids, we had no credit cards, so we'd paid in cash. And the world was not yet covered with perhaps the single most disgusting item on our planet today, fucking surveillance cameras. Still, our intent was just to get the hell out of the state. Steve and Frank had hit the tequila much harder than I and were soon asleep. I drove through the night, stopped once for gas, once again to take a leak. That was on the side of an unlit road somewhere so far into that desert, the only thing on the car radio was static. I felt like I'd left the world. Above was the most thickly starred sky I've ever seen. The black of the sky was nearly obscured by a pave of stars. It was as if the earth had been covered by a glass bowl and somebody had dropped a bag of glitter on it. That view cannot be had anywhere, at any price, in the Northeast. The sun was rising by the time we arrived at the mysterious preacher's house in Tucson. I was exhausted. Frank and Steve were still out cold in the car. I parked and trudged a couple of 100 yards into the desert and unrolled a sleeping bag against an enormous saguaro cactus. I was so tired, I didn't give a shit about rattlers, scorpions, or anything else. Most days in the desert, a wind kicks up in the late afternoon. Maybe it's a prompt to let the mountains know that it's time to turn purple. It cools off in a hurry then, and the larger animals start thinking about dinner. Something snorted in my ear. A javelina. When I moved, he vanished. I rolled the sleeping bag and stood up. The mountains had taken their cue from the wind and were once again the color of plum wine. The long shadows of the saguaro made the desert flora a bizarre patchwork. I faced west. Behind and below me was the city. In front of me was something I failed to recognize. My destiny. At that moment, my personal compass had been reset, and it only pointed one way, west. I'd had enough of crowds and subways and concrete.
couldn't give a shit about Broadway or the Met or the many cultural diversions that some New Yorkers find so necessary. That desert, those mountains, the two-lane blacktop, that lonesome yet rapturous feeling of being the last guy on this spinning ball hurtling through space, they gave me a thrill no front row ticket or stereo system ever could. A Peterbilt whined in the distance. For a minute, I actually thought I might stick out my thumb, see where I ended up. Then Frank called to me from the car. It was time to go home. It would be quite some time before I was finally able to return to the West, and not just for a visit. But in the interim, I still had much to do in the East. There were pointy chicks and mobsters to meet, a band to front, nutty jobs to do. It all worked out okay. Hey, thanks for hanging with me at the dojo. If you're wondering who's taking us out today, it is I, with a classic Western theme, reimagined with my own spin. I don't call myself a musician, but I do like to pick a guitar now and then. And just for Patreonies, I'm working on a little bonus mini-sode for all dojo belt levels, a video that covers this score, where we'll revisit some of the locales we talked about earlier, and a few others too weird to describe here. You'll just have to see it. I'm a bit late on this month's bonus episode, but it will appear shortly, including that chick meeting place that beats Dick Masterson's skating rink. Also coming soon, an online store with incredibly cool, must-have items from the Take No Shit Dojo. Stay tuned for details. And so, my friends, if you find yourself with a fire in the belly, with a wanderlust that can't be extinguished by day trips or long weekends, do it. Break free. Hit the road with a pal or solamente. You never know where the road will take you. See you next time, right here at the crossroads of madness and enlightenment. And until then, take no shit.